count prevented me from sleeping for a full 2 days and has permanently and irreversibly scarred me. Save your psyche while you still can and turn off your iPod. Women, you got nothing to fear. So the gay guy comes up and he says, I bet you've already slept with a man. I'm like, okay, man, come on. I mean, I invented Tucker Max Drunk, but not even Tucker Max Drunk makes you switch fucking teams. So he says, okay, well, how many women have you been with? I'm like, I don't know, somewhere in the low 3 digits. He's like, oh yeah, I bet you fucked a man. So I'm getting frustrated at this point. Okay, how? So he says to me, I have 3 words for you. Post-op transsexual. It took a few seconds for the full meaning and significance of that statement to filter through my drunken brain. What? Get the fuck out of here. I have never fucked one of those. You wouldn't know. Man, come on, give me some credit. Have you ever slept with a woman who told you she couldn't naturally lubricate, that she had to use KY? Oh, no. I'm like, well, yeah, 2, actually. He says, yeah, I'm like, no way. Stacy was one. I went to college with her. She was definitely a woman. Everything about her was woman. And she was like 17 when we fucked. You can't be post-op that young. He says, yeah, probably not. But what about the other one? I start thinking, oh, please, no. I say, well, I met her in Miami. What did she do? Well, she was a stripper. Okay, did she have fake tits? Yes. Oh, fuck, this isn't happening. He's got to be fucking with me. I say, no, man, she's not a fucking man. She didn't have an Adam's apple. It's a 2-hour outpatient surgery. Easily done. Cheap, too. I reply, no, but come on, man. She had a pussy. It felt like a pussy. Surgery is amazing these days. She probably even had a clit. Oh, man, what the fuck? I pause and I come back, but no, come on, man. She was soft. I mean, her skin, she felt like a girl. You're smart. You know what large amounts of estrogen do to the male body, don't you? But what about her voice? She didn't sound like those absurd trainings on Springer. Again, estrogen. Maybe even vocal cord surgery. It would make sense if she has a lucrative stripping or escorting gig to protect. I just stood there, too shocked to move, trying to recall every detail about her to refute his argument. Wait. He asked me. She gave great head too, didn't she? She was a stripper. They give head for a living. Fuck, this cannot be happening. He says, well, was she tall? Taller than you? Yeah, but I mean, I've dated lots of girls who were taller than me. But I bet none of them had hands as big as hers. Oh my God, I'm going to vomit. He asks, did you have anal sex with her? Yeah. Have you ever had anal sex with other girls? Yeah. Felt a little different with her, didn't it? Oh dear merciful Jesus. He was right. I distinctly remember that. I start to lose it. Fuck this. No fucking way that I fucked a fucking man. I think you did. Shut up. This can't be happening. I'm not hearing this. Don't feel bad, dude. This happens to lots of guys. You'd be shocked. Oh, motherfuck. No fucking way. This is not happening. I'm not having this conversation. What in dear God is going on? There's no way I fucked a fake woman. I was in shock. I could not sleep or function for the next 2 days as I went over every detail I could remember about this girl. I am still undecided about her. Yes, he made good points, but everything about her I recall as being feminine. The way she smelled, her touch, her appearance, everything. And it was a nice strip club where I met her, Rachel's, in West Palm Beach. Don't they check for these things? He went on to explain that some post-op trainees will go to the bathroom before sex and put the KY in without even telling the guy. Others don't even have fake breasts because the elevated estrogen levels can give them B cups. He said she might not have been the only one. My brain was completely fried after that conversation. I still don't know what to think. Gentlemen, all I can say is don't spend too much time cataloging your ex hookups because it's going to drive you nuts. Just pretend you never heard this and move on. You wish you had heeded that warning I gave you now, don't you? The now infamous Tucker Max charity auction debacle. The story occurred September of 2000 and was written September of 2002. Everything I'm about to tell you is true. This is the complete and unadulterated story, as I can best remember it, behind my infamous summer with Fenwick and West and the very famous Tucker Max charity auction debacle email. Let's start from the beginning. In May of 2000, my buddy Slingblade and I drove out to Palo Alto to work as summer associates at a law firm called Fenwick and West. It was the summer between our second and third years of law school at Duke. The internet and tech boom was hitting its crescendo, and as we arrived in Silicon Valley, the Nasdaq was set to pass 5,000. You remember those days? Almost immediately upon arrival, I realized that I hated being a lawyer. My mental picture of what being a lawyer entailed did not include spending countless hours every day sitting in a lifeless office, surrounded by boring people, doing idiotic and ultimately meaningless paperwork. Unfortunately, that is all a corporate lawyer does. When you're a lawyer, your job is to clean up the messes of others, to rubber stamp and make legal someone else's real work, to essentially be a paper custodian for the people who actually do important things. The people at Yahoo and Cisco and Network Solutions, all our clients, actually did something. What did I do? Stupid, mindless, and utterly irrelevant bullshit. I was a junior paper monkey, no less, and I hated every second of it. Honestly, I wish I could say it was the firm. I wish I could blame the people or the place. But that was not the case. I hated the very nature of the job. Being a lawyer just sucks. When I am bored or unhappy, my behavior becomes akin to a crack-addled ADD monkey until I find something to occupy me. The law firm and the work bored me. So what did I do? Did I endure the boredom and soldier on? Or better yet, did I find a productive output for my creativity like I did with my website in law school? No. I got drunk and acted like an asshole. Virtually every day, and especially at firm events where liquor was free. If being a lawyer was not interesting, I was going to make it that way, goddammit. The first Friday I was there, the firm had an all-day orientation for incoming summer associates. The night before, I got my roommate and myself into the South Market magazine opening party in San Francisco, where I got completely shit-faced and went home with one of the models at the party. Well, at least she told me she was a model, but who really knows? When I woke up at 6 a.m. the next morning, in her house in Oakland, I realized that I had not carefully thought out the ramifications of this act. My firm is far from Oakland, and I had to be at work at 9 a.m. for the start of summer associate orientation. First things first, I rooted around in her purse, noting the large supply of condoms, and found her driver's license so when I woke her up, I'd know her name. It was one of those nights. She said she'd give me a ride, but she can't take me to my place because it was in Mountain View, which is even further away from Oakland than Palo Alto, and she had to be somewhere at 10. That meant I had to wear the same clothes I wore out last night to work Friday. Not really a big deal, except there was liquor, vomit, piss, and probably other fluids all over them. Liquor is understandable, but vomit and piss? On the way to her house Thursday night, we had stopped at Jack in the Box. Don't ask me how she could eat that crap and still have such a good body. She wasn't a plus-size model, so I guess she was bulimic. Sitting in the drive-thru, the inhuman amounts of liquor I had consumed caught up to me, so I calmly got out of the car, walked behind a bush, and proceeded to vomit and piss at the same time. It is hard enough to keep from vomiting on yourself when you're drunk. Try doing it while you're also pissing. Whatever. I just put in a breath mint and hid the urine stains until they dried, and she still hooked up with me. Isn't alcohol great? I show up at orientation, stumbling drunk, eyes still bloodshot, smelling like a speakeasy. I somehow made it through without incident until after lunch, when they partnered us up with another summer associate and had us tell each other all kinds of things about ourselves, and then recite to everyone else in the room what we learned. I didn't know what to say to the guy who was my partner, so I told him I was out all night and I couldn't say anything because my contacts had fallen out when I was hooking up with some random girl. He stood up and told this to everyone. I thought it was pretty funny. The hiring partner did not. Whatever. If he can't take a joke, fuck him. The next week, the hiring partner, John Steele, came down to the office that I shared with three other summers and started shooting the shit with us. All of a sudden, he started talking about the information.com greedy associate boards and how he couldn't believe that the Fenwick summer salary info got up there so fast and how that thing has really changed the way that firms do things. Let me digress here for an important and revealing subplot. During the spring, Fenwick announced that they were going to pay summer associates only $2,100 per week, which was below the $2,400 that most big firms in New York, LA, and Chicago were paying their summers. Yet, right before we arrived in Palo Alto, Fenwick, along with every other Silicon Valley firm, announced that they were going to pay summers $2,400 per week, commensurate with the big firms in other major cities. What does this have to do with anything? Well, I was almost single-handedly responsible for Fenwick and basically every other Silicon Valley firm raising their summer associate salary from $2,100 to $2,400. How's that possible, you ask? The beauty of the internet and the influence of an amazing website called information.com. Information.com is a job-related website that has message boards on it where anyone can anonymously post anything. The message boards are divided by region, one being for New York associates, one for Silicon Valley, one for Chicago, etc. These message boards, called greedy associate boards, had vaulted to fame in the preceding months as a means for associates at different firms to anonymously share information with each other about salary, benefits, work conditions, etc. One of the sparking events for this was when Gunderson, a relatively small firm in Silicon Valley, raised their starting associate salaries from somewhere around the industry average of $100,000 to $125,000. One of the first places this information was posted and disseminated was the message boards on information.com. And from that event, as well as a few others like it, junior associates at all the major firms started sharing info with each other about the relative benefits and detriments of their particular firms on these greedy associate boards. As a result of these developments, Partners at all the major firms monitored these message boards, looking for the latest gossip about their firms and their competing firms. They had to stay up to date, because a change in benefits from firm A could mean a flood of associates or law students to that firm, and away from firm B, before firm B even knew what was going on. How does this relate to the story? The summer salaries had already been announced in New York at $2,400, and everyone was waiting for the Silicon Valley firms to announce their summer salaries. Fenwick was the first to announce. They did so sometime around late April and announced at $2,100, which was obviously below New York salaries. I was unhappy with this, so I immediately posted this info on the information.com Silicon Valley Greedy Associate board, and then, using four or five different anonymous screen names, proceeded to have a threaded discussion with myself on how horrible this was and how Fenwick was insulting its summers, how no one was going to accept their offers because the firm was so cheap it wouldn't fork over the extra $300 a week, etc., etc., etc. I even used one of my aliases to play the other side of the argument. It was fucking beautiful. Of the 20 messages on this topic on the first day, I probably posted 10 of them. I kept this up at a slightly lower output for about 3 days. About a week after Fenwick's announcement and the resulting information.com message board explosion, Wilson Sonsini, which is another firm in Silicon Valley, announced that they were paying Summers $2,400. Each of the other Silicon Valley firms quickly fell in line after that, including Fenwick. Now back to the story. So here I was, sitting with a hiring partner at a major Silicon Valley law firm, talking about the very message boards that I used to influence the summer salary structure when he let this little clincher go. Yeah, what kills me is that we had decided to pay $2,100, but as soon as we announced, that message board blew up and the other firms decided to pay $2,400. That thing is something else. Holy shit. The whole time I'm thinking, haha, asshole, the fucking joke's on you. I basically wrote that whole thread myself. It took everything I had not to laugh right in his face. So we all bullshit a little more, but then he asked to talk to me in private. He took me to a conference room, closed the door, and began talking to me about my reputation, about how I'm starting to get the reputation as sort of the party guy in the summer associate class. Yeah, so? At this point, I'm not really concerned about my reputation. Yeah, I like getting paid $2,400 a week for what amounted to summer camp, but I hated this job and I hated being a lawyer. Plus, the way he phrased the conversation, I just thought he was talking about unimportant stuff. At this point in my life, I wasn't very adept at picking up subtle social cues, and even though this was not a subtle one, I wasn't picking it up. I did a couple other stupid things the next few days. I can't really remember them because they were things that don't even register on my radar as events, yet others found them to be seismic. For instance, one day, one of the recruiters came into my office when I was on the phone. She asked who I was talking to, and I said, oh, I was just calling a porn line. Obviously, I was kidding. I later found out that she was utterly mortified and thought I was serious. The next day, I get invited to sit in on a meeting with a prospective client, the managing partner, and a senior associate. The client is a college girl who's an aspiring artist, a very good one, and about to graduate from Stanford. A Stanford alumni venture capitalist in the area told her that she should incorporate herself and set up what amounts to a startup company based around her work. She came to us for legal advice about this venture. Well, I may have been the junior person in the room, but I'm sorry, she was given some serious horseshit advice, and I proceeded to tell her this point blank. I mean, who's ever heard of this? Incorporating a new artist? Is this a joke? I'm not even talking about securitizing her future work and selling bonds like what David Bowie did. This VC wanted her to literally set up a corporation with herself and pass out stock options based on the future value of her work to get people to work for her. I told her to ignore this VC, that he knows nothing about the art world, and that for her to get an agent or a manager or both and start producing some art to sell and show, and then incorporating herself would be against her interests in both the long and the short term. And it's completely unheard of in the art world, and for good reason, because it's idiotic. It doesn't work with an art model. I thought the meeting went well. Apparently the managing partner did not. He was upset that I called the venture capitalist idea, someone who is apparently very important in Silicon Valley, idiotic. The next day I get a call from John Steele to come see him in his office. I go up there and he gives me another talk about my attitude. Really, don't let anyone tell you they weren't patient with me at Fenwick, because they were. But he told me that the good news was that the lawyers I was working with, a senior associate and a partner, thought the work I was doing was great, and they really liked me. Of course, I took this as carte blanche to keep doing what I was doing. I mean, as long as my work was good, that's all that matters, right? Yeah, not when you act like Sucker Max. Then he ends the conversation with this little quote. Oh yeah, I saw your little Bachelor of the Week thing on sfgirl.com. That was really funny. What? How did he find out about this? Then he continued. The part about the dog pound, I was in tears reading that. My wife thought it was hilarious. Of course, I wish I hadn't mentioned Fenwick, or a fat Puerto Rican stripper, but, you know, I guess that's just you. I didn't think I told anyone at Fenwick about that. I felt like Tom Cruise in the firm, but unlike Tom Cruise, I just willfully ignored the warning signs and kept on being myself. Friday rolls around and we have a firm cocktail party at a partner's house. The liquor was free, and I was drinking, and after an hour or so, I find myself talking to two female partners, Betty and Kathy. Betty's in her 40s, married, has a kid or two, and is one of the leading female partners in the firm. I'm my normal, gregarious, boisterous self, and these two female partners are eating it up, loving me. As the cocktail party winds down, I convince them to join me, 10 other summer associates, and a few junior associates, in a trip to a local Palo Alto bar. At this point, I'm just inviting them because I want someone to pay. On the trip over to the bar, I'm in the car with Betty and the other partner, and the conversation turns to sex. At first, I was a little reticent, being that Betty is married with children and an important partner. But before I know it, I'm explaining the BJ rule to them, in essence, what it means to dot someone's I's, and why guys do such things. This was eminently interesting to Betty and the other partner. The conversation carried into the bar and further explored such topics as whether a young man, like myself, around 24, would know what to do with an older woman, around 40 or so, whether my lips were pouty or sultry or alluring, you know, stupid things like that. We're all sitting at a long table, and by the time the food comes, I have Betty hand-feeding me calamari. All the while, Jim, another Duke Law summer associate, sat across the table from the scene, unable to believe what he was witnessing, and, you know, typical lawyer, eating ribs with a fork. Needless to say, this scene was just too much for most of the other summer associates, and the look on the face of one of the junior associates was priceless when I leaned over and asked her if the woman feeding me calamari was actually a partner. Yeah, I was a little out of control. Eventually, everyone scatters except me, Betty, Kathy, and one other summer. I'm assuming they saw the train wreck coming and didn't want to be anywhere near it when it hit. Probably a smart decision. My car was still at the firm, so Betty offers to give me a ride to the office to get it. I accept, and then another summer, Brian, invites himself along. Oh, I need a ride to the office too. I didn't really understand why at the time, but Betty gave him a mean look, but eventually agreed to take him along. As a side note, the only reason I can tell you this next part is because truth is an absolute defense to libel, and this particular event had a sober witness named Brian, who went to law school at Columbia, who was there. Although it may seem libelous, this is the complete truth. I'd been drinking, but I remember this vividly. If you don't believe this, find him, ask him about it. He's got no reason to lie for me. We get to the firm, and Brian and I get out of Betty's car, and then she turns off the car and then gets out herself. She looks up at the building. Fenwick has a 10-story building in Palo Alto, and then looks right at me and says, "Ah, it looks like I left the lights on in my office. I should probably go and turn them off. What do you think?" I'm oblivious to the implied meaning here, and look up and say, "Whatever, who cares? They're halogen. It'll cost like 3 cents for the night. Forget it." Betty gets a mildly frustrated look on her face, and still staring right at me says, "I need to go up to my office and turn off my lights. Maybe you should come up there and help me out." Did I ever mention how retarded I am when I get drunk? Yeah, well, I miss that signal too. "Nah, whatever, they're fine, don't worry about it." She kind of pauses for a second, looks right into my eyes and says, "Do you want to come help me turn off the lights in my office?" Bingo, that one registered. What did I do? Did I go with her up to her office and fuck the shit out of her? Did I dot her I's on her desk? Did I show her that this 24-year-old knew exactly what to do with a 40-year-old? No. In perhaps the single stupidest move of my life, I quickly said no, jumped into my car, and peeled out of the parking lot. The irony here is so fucking thick it's ridiculous. There is no category that Betty falls into that I have not slept with before. I've hooked up with women as old as her, uglier than her, more married than her, more children than her, everything. Shit, I have a hard time counting the number of times I've turned down sex at all, unless the girl was ugly and my friends were around. So why did I chicken out? Why did I pass up on such a sure thing? I don't fucking know. That's the worst part. I can't figure out what happened. It's like for 5 minutes of my life, I was a moral Puritan. The next weekend was the firm retreat at Silverado Ranch in Napa Valley. My roommate and I drove up Friday afternoon in my car, checked into the hotel, and then met everyone in the reception area. Starting around 7 p.m., there were cocktails and hors d'oeuvres, and then at 9 p.m., the charity auction was starting. I get to the reception promptly at 6:58 to find numerous well-stocked open bars and no food. Okay, there were some shrimp, perhaps some baklava, maybe even a pedophore or two, but nothing substantive to eat. Well, hello, what do you think is going to happen? Did no one involved in planning this thing ever hear of the behavioral effects of alcohol on an empty stomach? By the time the auction started, I was so drunk I was walking around carrying, seriously, two bottles of wine in my hands, red in my left, white in my right, taking alternating swigs from each. I sat, clutching my wine bottles, at a table right next to the stage with my roommate, about maybe five or six other summer associates, and a few junior associates. The charity auction was only for the 400-plus people working at the firm and their spouses, and was basically all firm-specific events. Things like managing partner would cook you dinner, or you could throw some things at some other partner, or, you know, you get to have a chair from the partner's office or something like that. I forget where the money was going. Probably to, you know, something like our Sisters of the Festering Rectum Orphanage or who knows. Most of the things were stupid. So I just sat there and solemnly poured wine into my face. Then an item came up which, in my drunken stupor, I simply had to have. The hiring partner, John Steele, would chauffeur you around for a night in his Cadillac. Beautiful. I thought, in my inebriated stupor, if I were to buy this, then they were going to have to give me an offer. That's how drunk I was. The bidding started at $50. It slowly went up to 60, then 80, then 100, so I got bored and just stood on my seat and held my paddle up. The auctioneer took this as a sign to just start yelling out ever-increasing numbers, never even looking at the other bidders. The bid got to around $600 with no one bidding but me, and I yelled at him to quit. One or two other people might have thrown a bid in there when John Steele got on the mic and said that if a summer won, he'd pay half. Predictably, this doubled the bidding immediately. When the bidding hit about 2,000, I thought I had won. No one else was bidding when all of a sudden, Aparna, another summer who was good friends with me, knew the condition I was in, shit-faced drunk, and knew that, given my egomaniacal personality, I would not stop bidding, ever, no matter what, regardless of the price. So with the help of a few partners bankrolling her, she started slowly bidding me up. 2,200, 2,300, 2,400. Next thing I know, I'm on stage, and I grab the microphone from the auctioneer and start yelling at her. I'm doing it in a teasing way, but I'm like, Aparna, what are you doing? You know you can't afford this. You're just trying to mess with me. I have to win this. It's the only way I'm getting an offer. This sends the crowds into fits of laughter. I wasn't even trying to be funny, but hey, put some liquor in me and you never know what's going to come out. He kicks me off the stage. The betting gets up to about 3,300 or so, and I climb back on stage, wrestle the mic away from the auctioneer, and start yelling, this is not fair. You have partners bankrolling you. I only have a few scrubby summers in my corner. Seriously, Aparna, I need this. Quit! Again, eruptions of laughter. The bidding eventually hits 3,800. And this time the auctioneer says, all right, Tucker, come on up here. I know you're coming up here anyway. I get on stage and eventually I have to make the call. Do I go to 3,900 or not? Microphone in hand, in front of everyone, I say, fuck it, go ahead. The funny thing is, people not associated with the firm think this is why I got fired. It's not really true at all. The managing partner came up to me afterwards and told me that it was the funniest thing he'd ever seen at a firm event. The name partner, Bill Fenwick, told me, literally, that I did Kentucky proud. We were both from Kentucky. Another partner I didn't know told me I was awesome. For the rest of the night, I was a star. Believe it or not, that's the absolute truth. We end up back at the hotel, and the summer associates and some other junior associates go to someone's suite, and we're playing cards, drinking, and socializing. It was about this point that I had blacked out. My last clear memory is trying to convince some summer to beat up an associate, because he was cheating at poker. The next day, Eric told me that I tried to hook up with Aparna, but all I could manage to do was pass out on top of her. It was that kind of night. I wake up the next morning, it's like 11 a.m., and I feel like a bag of ass. All the summer associates were supposed to be at the morning lecture given by the managing partner and some other guy. They were there, and I was not. I throw something on and make it there right as it's finishing. Someone tells me that Gordy, the managing partner, asked on the microphone if I was there when it began at 9 a.m. So I go up to him afterwards and I say, hey, I made it, eventually. He smiled, shook his head, and said, well, there's always one. Fast forward to Monday. I'm sitting in my office, bored out of my mind, when I decide to write my friends and tell them what happened over the weekend. So I compose the now infamous email. It's pretty much exactly what I just told you, maybe with a few less details and a few more jokes thrown in. That's about it. I only sent the email to about 10 friends. And then, you know, I thought nothing else about it. They didn't even think it was that great. I had some much better stories that summer, like the one about the Soma party and about this Korean girl who raced me to home during 120 and the 101, things like that. You get the picture. So that was Monday. Wednesday comes, and around 4:30 p.m., John Steele asked me to come to his office. His office is only one floor above mine, so I decided to take the stairs. I stroll up there and notice that my key card, which I have to have to operate the elevators or doors, isn't working. This could only mean one thing. I get into his office, and he's in there with some other lady I've never seen before. John introduces her, some HR lady, and then proceeds to tell me that I have an option to either voluntarily withdraw from the firm or get fired. He cited certain things that I had done that led them to this course of action, like my porn line comment and some other stuff, meaningless stuff like that, but said nothing about the really bad stuff I had done. If I withdraw, he tells me they will pay me a large separation sum, pay my rent for the summer, and pay for the item I won at the charity auction. In total, this is close to $20,000. Plus, I get to keep what I've already made in the not quite 4 weeks I was there. If I get fired, I get nothing. I'm a little bit in shock, but not really. One of the associates at the firm, who is no longer there, heard about this and gave me a heads up the day before. I took the money, thanked them, and headed out. It all went rather pleasantly, considering. Granted, I'd acted a little reckless, but I was nonetheless confused. I figured I wasn't getting an offer, but I didn't think I was going to get fired. And the reasons he gave for them letting me go were bullshit. They had plenty of reasons, real reasons, to get rid of me, don't misunderstand. But the ones John named did not seem like reasons to fire a summer associate. The next day I got two phone calls, both from associates at the firm. One talked to me on the phone, the other met me for lunch a few days later. They both thought I had been dealt with the wrong way, and independently told me basically the same thing. I got canned mainly because of the incident with Betty, the female partner, and not because of the charity auction. The one who met me for lunch claimed he had talked to a very important partner in the firm, and he was told that, given my track record of outlandish behavior, the firm was scared I was going to eventually sleep with her or do something even worse than that, which would either make me a huge liability, for instance, if I got drunk and set the building on fire, or invincible, if I had slept with Betty. Why would that make me invincible? Because if she slept with me, and they didn't give me an offer, then they could be liable for a sexual harassment suit. Not that I would ever sue them if that happened, but considering my behavior that summer, I can understand why they viewed me as a liability. I was never able to verify these theories, but they seemed to make sense to me. To me, the most delicious irony is that, ultimately, because I didn't sleep with Betty, the firm was able to get me out. Can you believe that? Because I didn't fuck her, I fucked myself. But that's not all. About a month later, my email started popping up. Everywhere. My buddy, who I had sent it to originally, Paul, had forwarded it to Linda Brewer, a dookie at another Silicon Valley firm, who forwarded it to some other people, and you get the picture. That email went around the world several times, and at last count went through like 100-plus firms and countless lawyers. The next thing I know, my inbox is filled with these forwards, and my friends from all over the country are calling me like, dude, what happened? Is that really you? My favorite random email I got was from a guy who wrote, Mr. Max, with the hope of a 6-year-old in the night before Christmas asking about Santa, I asked the same question. Do you really exist? I called John Steele a few months later for some reason, and the first thing he said to me was, man, you're famous. We've been collecting those emails, and we've counted over 100 firms they've been to. Hey, man, congrats. It was really well written, too. I swear to God, I had that conversation with him. My mother even got that email. My uncle's a lawyer in D.C., and he got it and forwarded it to her. Her only comment? Well, I guess that's what happens when you can't hold your liquor. I became a minor celebrity in the legal world after that. Every law student and lawyer in the country knew about me. Someone told me that some students at Columbia Law threw a Save Tucker party. I wish someone would have told me about it. I probably would have shown up. Of course, that would have been anticlimactic. When I got back to Duke, the dean of students wrote me a letter telling me that I should go into alcohol rehab. I thought that was pretty funny. That is the whole true story, exactly as I remember it. In the final analysis, I have almost nothing bad to say about Fenwick. Yeah, they fired me, but I can understand their position. I acted like a drunk retard, and they couldn't tolerate my potential liability. What could I expect them to do? Pat me on the back and get me a hooker and some beer? I mean, that would be pretty cool. But seriously, I hold no ill will towards them. I probably would have done the same thing had I been in their position and some jerk-off had come in acting like me. I often get asked if I regret what I did. I'm never exactly sure how to answer that. I mean, yeah, I would like to have kept making $2,400 a week for the summer, but in the end, it was probably the best thing for me. I hated being a lawyer, but the money was so good, I don't know if I would have just ultimately had the courage to quit on my own. I probably would have just languished in a job I hated, doing just enough to get by, and would become bitter and disillusioned, just like pretty much every lawyer I know. So instead, I did the immature thing and forced the issue, leaving the decision up to Fenwick, and they made it for me. Oh well, what can you do? The Austin Road Trip. This story occurred in October of 2000 and was written in September of 2003. Early in my third year of law school, I was sitting in the law library with my crew of friends, skipping class and trading stories about our summers. At first, I was the center of attention, having just come off the summer of the infamous Tucker Max charity auction debacle, but my buddy PWJ quickly trumped me. He told us a story about a gentleman's club he frequented in Dallas, a place far different than the common strip club. The first time I got a lap dance there, I was kind of reticent about touching her, but the stripper grabbed my hands and put them on her tits. During the second dance, she turned around and basically dry-humped me for the entire song. I didn't get a third dance, but if I did, I could have all but had sex with the girl. She was smoking hot, and wasn't even close to being the best one there. And the very best part? $5 cover charge, $2 bottles and wells. We, of course, initially called bullshit, but PWJ finally convinced us that this lost city of Cibola did in fact exist. We were greatly excited. My buddy John Binet summed it up, and I used to think there was a bright line between a gentleman's club and a brothel. Now you're telling me it's just gray. This place was called Baby Dolls, and it became our holy grail. We immediately planned a trip to Dallas. At the outset, all 10 of us were in. But as the departure date loomed closer, various friends started taking dives. Golden Boy bailed because he had just returned from a week-long trip to Russia and didn't want to be apart from his fiancée for so long. I won't say anything bad about this because he eventually married her, and I really like her, so I guess this turned out to be a good decision. if you're into the whole responsibility and love stuff. Hate decided to go on an interview. Unlike me, he was upset about not having a job. Brownhole is basically a pussy and a sycophant who was afraid that being arrested with us would ruin his political career. None of us are sure how he even got into our group. Credit was dating a girl that Sling Blade once referred to as the most evil demon slut in the long history of female chicanery and deception. Credit is a spineless coward and wanted to keep dating her, so we begged off the trip. JoJo made the same decision he makes whenever he sees a bunch of crazy white boys run off to go get in trouble. He went the opposite way. JonBenet had the most ridiculous excuse. Instead of going on the trip, he flew to Boston with his girlfriend, a friend of Credit's evil demon slut girlfriend, to look at apartments. To look at apartments, notwithstanding the fact he wasn't moving there for an entire year. There's a reason why he got kicked out of the group. That left only four travelers. Because he was on Law Review, PWJ had lots of important and uppity legal talking to do. Luckily, he follows his penis around like a divining rod, so he promptly cleared his schedule. Slingblade's busy schedule included drinking alone in the dark and jacking off to his Star Trek Limited Edition 7 of 9 poster, so he was solidly in. Albingeroso had already planned a trip to visit a friend in Austin, so he combined his trip with ours, and then got his fiancée some sort of shiny trinket to distract her from his new plans. I was able to squeeze the trip in between outings at Chapel Hill involving sex and drinking, interspersed with some drinking and sex. On a crisp Thursday night in early October, Slingblade, PWJ, Albingeroso, and I began our journey to Dallas. We would soon become known to the state of Texas by biblical names, pestilence, plague, hunger, and death. Our first stop was a Steak and Shake somewhere outside of Charlotte, where we bonded with each other by recounting tales of our fucked up youths. I recall the childhood colored by parental instability, multiple divorces, remarriages, 7 between my 2 biological parents, step-parents, constant relocation, loneliness, and emotional pain. No one cared about my problems, because they already read about my father's most recent divorce in Time magazine and didn't need any more details to know I was fucked up. PWJ told us of an awkward youth being the son of an army colonel, where his Styx jean jacket and obsession with all things vehicular could not make the Kansas yokels overlook his abnormally misshapen egghead and triple-digit IQ. Popular he was not, but since none of us are his normal dim-witted, naive teenage girl prey, we didn't care. While his age, 3 years older than us, gave him a wisdom and maturity that none of us yet possessed, under this composing and passionate exterior, PWJ could be the biggest fucking snake of the group. The fact that he grew up smart but a social outsider forced him to learn game the hard way, but also planted a retributive mean streak. Even though he's more often than not the voice of reason in the group, he is also the one who will manipulate an innocent 18-year-old girl into sex with lies and deception. Whereas the rest of us just find the slutty girls who want to fuck and let them do what comes natural. Slingblade regaled us with tales of his emotionally distant, risk-averse, and overprotective parents, who split time yelling at him and cloistering him in his room. His was a youth spent with action figures as his friends and a Nintendo as his babysitter. He also told us perhaps the most defining story of his life. He and his high school girlfriend, the love of his life, went to different undergrads. He spent the first semester of college passing up on sex with every girl who approached him, and there were many, because he was naive and in love and didn't want to cheat on his girlfriend. She did not possess the same integrity, so she cheated on him. A lot. And didn't tell him until he went down to visit her and noticed that guys kept coming by her room, asking what she was up to later that night. Slingblade does not deal well with emotional pain, and as such, he is now bitter and imputes her cuckoldry on all women. But it was Albingeroso who really stole the show. He grew up in a very small town in Nebraska, about 700 people, one Dairy Queen and one stoplight. He remembered his father and brother making him run timed 100-meter races against each other, at age 6. When he got to elementary school, he was fat and would constantly eat paste, so the teachers just assumed he was retarded and put him in the special ed class. He was in the special ed program until age 8 when they finally gave him an IQ test and realized he was a genius and moved him to the gifted class. He was actually upset about leaving the sped class because he liked the coloring and the frequent snack times. He also told us about the time that he and his brother, aged 9 and 11, watched from the locked car while their dad beat up a mugger, nearly killing him by repeatedly smashing his head into the hood and fender, spraying blood all over the car. I have subsequently met Albingeroso's father, and believe me, he is not a man to cross. I have a healthy and robust fear of him. But what really distinguished him from the rest of us was that he was truly in love and actually had a stable life. Even though Albingeroso was a partier like the rest of us, he loved his fiancée, was totally committed to her, and was very excited that he had finally convinced her to wear a French maid outfit to the Duke Law Halloween party. We arrived in Dallas on Friday afternoon. After a quick nap, we went to an early dinner at some Mexican place in Deep Ellum, then across the street to a roadhouse-type bar designed for yuppies. Both Pabst and Guinness on tap. Metrosexuals dressed in brown lycra as far as I could see. I immediately hated everyone. We get 2 pitchers and decide to play table shuffleboard. Barely into our first pitcher, I noticed 2 girls checking us out. A hot blonde and a decent redhead. They stare at us for about 10 minutes. I want to have sex with the blonde, so I start things off. Hey, you gonna come over here and talk to us, or are you just gonna stand there and stare? They accept my invitation. I stare at the tits on the blonde, and they are nearly flawless and quite seductively exposed. The girl knows what she's doing. Despite my nearly forensic examination, she doesn't really notice though, I'm a pro at this. I keep the conversation moving along nicely until dumbass El Benjaroso decides to fuck everything up. The blonde asks, so, what brings you guys to Dallas? El Benjaroso replies, we came to go to a strip club. Yeah, he's an engaged, cock-blocking jerk. Thanks, asshole. I didn't want to fuck her or anything. The redhead chimes in at this point, kind of pulling me aside from El Benjaroso. Did you really come to Dallas to go to a strip club? No, baby. We had a week off from law school, so we came to visit some friends, hang out, that sort of thing. El Benjaroso just wants to go to a strip club he heard about. Do you like strip clubs? Those places are gross. Yeah, they are kind of gross, but my friends really want to go, so what can I do? I don't know anyone in Dallas. Besides, I like naked breasts. You can stay here, hang out with me. Yeah, maybe. And maybe I'll watch reruns of Alf on Telemundo. No thanks. El Benjaroso tugs on me. Dude, you might want to get in on this. He turns back to the blonde. You think you want to come to Baby Dolls with us? She replies, I'll come to the strip club with you guys. I want to see some big titties. I like this. I'm a fan. Have you ever been to Baby Dolls before? Yeah, I auditioned there once. Ding, 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 ding. There we go. We got a winner. El Benjaroso asks, so, do you like girls? She responds, of course. Excellent. All we need now is 70s music to start playing. We've got a porno in the making. I glance at the other end of the table. It's our turn to throw the pucks, but El Benjaroso and I haven't paid attention for 10 minutes. Slingblade is glaring at me with his standard half-bored, half-disdainful, another whore expression that he always gives me when I start talking to random girls. I motion for him to come down to our end of the table, and then I see PWJ. Great holy Jesus. It looks like he fell into Kentucky Fried Movie. He's talking to a woman with a leopard cowboy hat on over a platinum bouffant hair. Her makeup looks like it was applied with a shotgun. She has on tight orange hot pants, which she obviously brought from her last job at Hooters. Around her waist is a belt, and there appears to be a toy gun holster to it. She was probably very attractive in, say, 1986. Now she's in the death throes of a losing battle against time and fashion irrelevance. I ask Slingblade, dude, who is PWJ talking to? Slingblade just shrugs. I don't know. Some whore. She squirted him with her water gun and off he went. She has big tits. Cupid has spoken. 15 more minutes of bullshitting and the blonde is sealed up. She's coming to Baby Dolls with us. Unfortunately, the only way she'll do it is if the redhead comes, too. But she's not enthused at all about the prospect of going to one of those places. I am presented with a logistical nightmare. I want to fuck the blonde, who's throwing her pussy at El Benjaroso. The only way she's going to Baby Dolls is if redhead comes. Redhead's in love with me, but does not want to come to Baby Dolls. El Benjaroso is drunk and no help. So what do I do? Here's where taking econ classes at the University of Chicago helps out with real-life game. This is a classic example of the prisoner's dilemma. If I keep paying attention to the blonde and try to capture my small chance to fuck her, I will probably fail, and then I get no pussy. And the group gets no lesbian action at the strip club, because neither will come with us. Everyone loses. But if I take one for the team, ignore the blonde, and instead seal up the redhead, I can get both to come with us to Baby Dolls. This means that I probably won't fuck the blonde, which decreases my chance of personal happiness. I will give the group the best chance to maximize the situation by getting two girls to come to the strip club. And maybe I'll hook up with the redhead. See? Even Tucker Max can be altruistic, if it benefits them. I turn to the redhead. All right, come on. Let's all go to the strip club. It'll be a good time. Don't go to a strip club. You know those girls don't care about you. Slingblade chimes in. That's not true. They sit on my lap and tell me they love me. Slingblade usually chooses the funny joke over the smart play. And this, folks, is why he gets no pussy. Well, that, and he has no confidence, is scared of emotional commitment to a woman because he thinks they're all cheating sluts. But whatever. Thanks, Slingblade, asshole. Why don't you go watch Deep Space Nine and leave this to me, dick? I pull redhead away from Captain No Pussy. Come on, sweetie. It'll be fun. Your friend wants to go anyway. I don't want to go to that place. It's gross. Yeah, I know. But I'll be there. We can hang out together. We'll let them look at the naked woman. And you and I can just hang out. Together. I actually reached out and put her hands in mine. Why don't you just stay here with me? Yeah, let's stay together. At the club. But I don't want to go to a strip club. But I want to go. With you. Us. Together. I don't even like it there. Have you ever been? No. I'll tell you what. If you and Blonde come with us, I promise that you and I can sit in a corner somewhere and stare into each other's eyes, completely ignoring everything around us. It'll be romantic. We'll be so busy staring into each other's eyes, we won't even see what's going on. Hearing myself say these words, I just about threw up in my own mouth. She paused and contemplated. No, I don't want to go to a strip club. I just can't. This is fucking great. Even I had my limit, and that staring into each other's eyes bullshit was it. Slingblade and El Benjaroso tire of this. Go fetch PWJ away from his water pistol-packing cow whore and start to leave. The redhead is trying to convince me to stay at the bar with her. She's almost pleading with me. Before I know it, my friends are already walking out the door. I make my way to follow them, the redhead still attached to my arm like a lamprey. I try to make a cost-benefit analysis. Probable hookup and possible sexual activity with redhead, or definite nakedness but little chance to hook up with baby dolls. I need to pin redhead down on our late-night activities. Look, are you going to hang out with me later tonight? I mean, are we going to hang out after we leave here? Like, at your place? My tone's not subtle. I don't know if I can. I have to be up at 7 a.m. 7 a.m.? For what? A Young Life meeting. I gotta go catch up with my friends. I streak out of the bar before she can even change her facial expression. As an aside, Young Life is a fundamentalist Christian youth group that preaches abstinence and all other sort of ridiculous pabulum. I got blue balls so many times in middle school and high school dealing with those fucking girls. Never again. In the car on the way to Baby Dolls, I asked PWJ about his little adventure. Dude, who the fuck was that woman you were talking to, and where did she get her uniform? At a Whores R Us closeout sale? I don't know, man. She works there. She had a toy water pistol on her belt. Is it wrong that turned me on? She works there. I guess no one cares if she spends 30 minutes talking to you. Apparently her job is to degrade herself and chat up pasty, thimble-headed geeks. No, you don't understand, Tucker. That's not the best part. I learned her philosophy of dating. Don't fish off the company pier and don't fuck your friends. I've tried both plenty of times. It never works. Oh, yeah. I nearly spat out my drink when she told me she has cats rather than kids because, and I quote, you don't go to jail when you get your cat's high. We decide we're starting to like Texas. Baby Dolls does nothing to derail this crazy train. Baby Dolls should be the model from which all strip clubs are cast. The neon glow from its trim molding and signage can be seen from miles away. A huge pink one-story standalone building rising out of a sea of asphalt with pictures of nearly naked girls on the four-story billboard looming over it from the parking lot. The entrance is two huge wooden doors adorned with brass fixtures and two NFL linebacker-sized bouncers. It is covered by a pink awning that extends up the walk about 10 feet. The huge oval main stage is flanked by an enfilade of four smaller side stages, each with a brass pole reaching from floor to ceiling. Mirrors cover every wall and extend to every ceiling. Two full bars and two beer bars are staffed by a phalanx of female bartenders and cocktail waitresses. And most importantly, it's all nude. No pasties. No G-strings, no crotch tape, nothing between you and the naked, nubile flesh of attractive women, except dollar bills. The girls were hot beyond hot, dozens of incredibly beautiful and sexy women, each giving smiles that convey the sincerity of a single mother with rent due. At age 24, this was my Elysium. Two dancers come over almost immediately after we sit down. The hot one is at least 5'10", blonde bobbed hair, smooth, almost creamy skin, and gorgeous fake breasts, perfectly round and sitting high on her chest. She plops down on PWJ's lap. So, what do you do? PWJ responds, I'm a law student. Wow, so do you go to SMU? Not exactly. I go to Duke. She gives him a blank stare. A few seconds later, one can almost see the flicker of candlelight in the thought bubble above her head. You mean Duke? He pauses and chuckles. Yeah, Duke. She gives him a doubtful look. Oh, like I've never heard this one before. Let me guess, you went to Harvard for college. Well, no, not exactly. In reality, PWJ went to Princeton for undergrad. I stopped paying attention because as much as I love beauty, I hate stupidity, and seeing the two combined just pisses me off. Plus, I need to start drinking, and her nipples aren't spouting vodka. I find a cocktail waitress and begin drinking. Combatively. I've driven 16 hours for the specific purpose of going to the strip club, and I'll be damned if I get here and nothing happens. To help achieve this end, getting drunk and making something happen, I make friends with our cocktail waitress, Liz. Gentle readers, let me explain something to you. It is an almost universal rule of gentlemen's clubs that the cocktail waitresses are more fun to talk to and more apt to fuck customers than the strippers. They're not as pressed for time, so they'll banter more. The limp dicks that overtip the strippers usually don't tip the cocktail waitresses at all, so attention to a cocktail waitress will get you much further than attention to a stripper. Plus, they tend not to be high or drunk on duty, whereas strippers are almost always in some altered state. So conversation with them can actually accomplish something. The funniest thing is that they always think they're better than the strippers. In their mind, there's a bright line separating them from the women who actually take their clothes off. Thus, it is usually much easier to get a cocktail waitress to go home with you. Strippers are jaded, abused, used up, they hate men, and usually for good reason. The cocktail waitresses are far less defensive. They're so used to being ignored or looked through that when you do pay attention to them, they respond to it. Some innocuous flirting and a good first tip to Liz gets my friends and me a constant, uninterrupted stream of drinks and flirtatious hottie hanging around us. Listen and learn, fellas. Back to the action. Sling Blade gets one of the hottest girls in the club to give him a dance. Before she takes his money, she tries to talk to him and actually seems genuinely interested, not just stripper interested. This probably has something to do with the happy confluence of his sarcastic, standoffish sense of humor and the inability of her stepfather to show her any affection growing up. So what does Slingblade do? Does he flirt with her? Does he at least try to exploit the situation? Of course not. He places his finger on her lips, patiently explains that he, quote, would rather mainline Drano than listen to her for another second, and commands, less talky, more booby. The kid has problems. Apparently, something about PWJ just says sucker, because another stripper comes up and puts her hands over PWJ's eyes, coyly whispering something erotic in his ear. She is ugly. Like, U-G-L-Y, she ain't got no alibi, her face looks like it lost a frantic battle with a rototiller. The woman is literally missing teeth. I can't tell for sure, but I think she has a tattooed tear on her left eye. I motion to PWJ by making a cutting gesture across my throat and yelling over the music. Dude, she is unattractive. Bottom of the barrel. Needs to put her clothes on and learn how to type. Don't do it. You're a young man. He doesn't get my warnings in time. She sits on his lap. PWJ tells her he doesn't want to dance, but she says it's okay and remains on his lap talking to him. I wonder, out loud for everyone to hear, if the zoo knows they're missing the three-toed sloth. She's not pleased. Fuck her. It's not my fault she looks like Adrian Brody with saggy tits. PWJ ignores me and continues engaging her in conversation. When I hear her say, yeah, I had two hearts tattooed on my hips, but then I got pregnant and carried my son on my left side. Now this one looks like a tomato. I just get up. I'd rather rip my penis out by the root than listen to another minute of her whore ramble. I saunter around flirting with waitresses and bartenders and strippers, double-fisting vodka and sodas, and then it happens. I see El Bingeroso's future wife. It's not actually her. That would be a story. But she looks exactly like El Bingeroso's fiance. It's fucking spooky. I immediately walk over to where she is and stand there, waiting for her to finish the dance she's giving to some random guy. He's less than pleased. Whatever, buddy. You're wearing a Detroit Red Wings jersey to a strip club. You obviously suck. I give her enough to pay for two dances for El Bingeroso and then an additional $10. I tell her she has to tell him her name is Christy, El Bingeroso's fiance's name, and to answer to nothing else. I point him out, and she walks over and introduces herself. Hi, I'm Christy. Dinner's on the stove, baby. After what seems like only 10 minutes, I glance over, and she's just sitting there talking to him. Fine. Maybe she's just warming him up. A few more minutes, same scene. I'll be damned if El Bingeroso doesn't get my money's worth. He's the type that would pay her more not to dance, thinking it would violate his relationship or some such bullshit. I walk over and interrupt El Bingeroso in the middle of a story I'd heard the day before. Yeah, I was fat when I was a kid. You know how kids' jeans at Kmart come in three different sizes, small, medium, and husky? I had to buy husky. I break in. El Bingeroso, what the fuck? Is stripper fiancé going to dance for you or what? El Bingeroso looks confused. What are you talking about? Dude, she already did both dances. She's just hanging out now. Maybe I'm drunker than I realize. I find Liz and ask her how many drinks I've had. She looks at me with the same look El Bingeroso gave me. Tucker, sweetie, what are you saying? I can't understand you. I guess I am fucked up. I try to stagger back to my seat when a very hot, voluptuous stripper grabs me by the belt loops and pulls me towards her. She has a skin-tight, tiger-striped bodysuit that is virtually painted on her. To say that her breasts were spilling out would be to imply that this outfit covered them at some point. Her J-Lo booty smiles at me and I smile back. It takes me a few seconds to find her eyes. I have to shade my eyes because the gobs of silver glitter eyeshadow smeared on her face are reflecting an inordinate amount of light. She says something to me, but I don't understand it. I pretend to listen for about 3 minutes and I interrupt her. If I were dating you, I'd never leave the house. I'd never even leave your general vaginal area, unless it was to come on your face. She thinks I'm funny. She really wants to give me a dance. I tell her I'm a starving lawyer and I can't afford one. But there's something about her. Maybe it's the lighting. Maybe it's her aggressive attitude. Maybe it's her ghetto booty. Maybe it's her 36 double D fake breasts pressing against me. Maybe it's the 3 margaritas, 6 beers, and 15 vodka clubs, but she just strikes me in that right way. I guess she saw the acquiescence in my eyes, because without any further deliberation, at least that I can remember, she drags me back to a secluded booth in the rear of the club and starts dancing. By this time, I'm so drunk, I even know I'm drunk. Another great feature of baby dolls. The strippers encourage you to touch their boobies. I exploit this privilege ruthlessly. I grab both her beautifully fake breasts full on. I was kneading her tits so hard, all I needed was a little water and some active dry yeast, and I could have made bread. Towards the end of the dance, I was actually trying to pop the saline implants. Those things are pretty durable. Finished, she snuggles herself up against me, breast right under my chin. So, do you want to go somewhere? More private? Yeah, sure. For what? Well, if we get a champagne room, we can do anything we want. Anything? Anything. Okay. It's $300 for the room, plus usually about $100 more. Depending. But you're cute. So $400 total. Uh-huh. I can vaguely recall a moral dilemma I might have had with this situation milling somewhere around my frontal lobes, provided I were sober enough to recall exactly what the tenets of my ethical system were, or even what an ethical system was. This drunk, I could only consider price. Thank you, University of Chicago economics classes. I tell her, I'll give you $20. She laughs. No, baby, it's $400. Okay, $22. Well, you're cute and funny. I'll do it for $350. $25. $325? No, just $25. I have to give the club $100 to get the room for an hour. I can't last an hour. I'll give you $28. This went on for at least 10 more minutes before we finally settled on a price. $55 for a half hour. I could write a fucking book on negotiation. And as drunk as I was, you can believe she earned her $5. When I found my friends, 2 hours and 55 wisely spent dollars later, they were out in the parking lot eating sloppy joes they bought from a guy out of the back of his Chevette. Needless to say, they were aghast. But in my vodka-addled brain, I had a defensible position. Dude, I had to. How could I pass up a bargain like that? It's a matter of principle. The next day, we woke up scattered across our hotel room, still clothed and reeking of hairspray and bar smoke. We pack up and head to Austin. On the way there, we see a huge sign on the road. This way to the Texas State Fair. El Bingeroso nearly has a fucking aneurysm. Oh, we have to go, Guys, the Texas State Fair. It is the most insane morass of trucks and rednecks and cheap carnival trinkets I've ever seen. Slingblade gets a funnel cake. I get a slushy. PWJ falls in love with the classic, read penis, cars. But it was El Bingeroso who really tapped into the essence of the Texas State Fair. He made friends with a fat, brown-toothed teenage redneck wearing a WWF Mankind t-shirt covered in mustard stains. The poor kid looked like he had the cultural IQ of someone who just staggered out of a sheep orgy. We see them standing over by some video game thing, and he waves us over. El Bingeroso says, guys, you see this thing? It's called the Shocker. You hold these metal handles here, and it sends an ever-increasing charge of electricity through you. As the wattage increases, so does your score, and if you can hold it all the way to the end, you win something. And this guy, he points to Jethro, thinks he can do it. I ask, well, what do you win? Slingblade says, a free electroshock treatment, apparently. PWJ turns to the redneck Jethro. You can't hold that for more than a few seconds. Fuck that, man, I can do it. El Bingeroso says, okay, man, give it your best shot. Here, we'll even put the money in. As PWJ put the dollar in the machine, the redneck rubbed his hands together and mentally prepared himself. I pulled El Bingeroso aside. He was giggling like a Japanese schoolgirl in a Hello Kitty store. Dude, who is this kid? What the hell's going on? El Bingeroso says, I saw him staring at this thing. I bet him he couldn't do it. He got all worked up. Dude, I've seen this thing knock out 250-pound guys before. They were outlawed in the state of Nebraska. This is awesome! Jethro firmly planted his feet, rubbed his face, spit into his hands, rubbed them together, and wiped them on his shirt. We started cheering him on. El Bingeroso screams, yeah! I yell, Eye of the Tiger! PWJ says, what does not kill you makes you stronger. Slingblade yells out, there is no spoon. Jethro mutters some inspirational phrases to himself, pressed the start button, and grabbed the two metal handles. For the first few seconds, he was fine. Then his arms started shaking. Then his shoulders. Then his head. Then his mouth began frothing and spitting saliva everywhere. Then this strange, guttural, animalistic groan emerged from him. Still gripping the handles, his whole body was in violent convulsions when an older woman pulled him off the machine. He fell to the ground and she yelled at him, Jethro, get away from that thing! They're making fun of you! I don't know if I've ever laughed so hard in my life. I was laying on the hot asphalt of the Texas State Fair, curled up in a ball, tears streaming down my face as I held my stomach muscles and convulsed with laughter. I was able to look up and see the confused, blank stare on Jethro's face as his mother let him off, wiping the spit off of his face, his arms still twitching slightly. I really hope that God has the capacity for forgiveness that Christians claim, because I'm going to test the absolute outer limits. We get to Austin and check in at the Embassy Suites. After a nap, El Bingeroso calls his friends. We all meet up at a place called Cheers Shot Bar on 6th Street. It was me, PWJ, Slingblade, El Bingeroso, and three of his college friends, Thomas, Dirty, and Mermaid. It was around 8 p.m. when we rolled in there, and the bar was nearly empty. Not a problem. We can make our own party. Mermaid tells the bartender, 7 flaming Dr. Peppers. At the time, I had no idea what a flaming Dr. Pepper was. The bartender set up 7 pint glasses, each about half full with light beer, in a sort of pyramid formation at the top of the bar. He filled 7 shot glasses, about 90% full of amaretto, then topped each off with Bacardi 151, and set them on the lips of the pint glasses. Then he took a huge swig of Bacardi 151. put a lighter up to his face, and blew the alcohol in his mouth through the flame, sending a massive fireball over the shot glasses, each of them catching on fire, nearly exploding. While they were still on fire, he hit one of the shot glasses, starting a domino effect, each shot glass falling into a pint glass, putting out the flames and fizzing the beer up. We each grabbed the glass and chugged it, and I'll be goddamned if it didn't taste exactly like Dr. Pepper. It was the coolest thing involving alcohol I've ever seen. Being OCD, I had to see it again. And again. And again. 6 rounds of flaming Dr. Peppers later, I was fucked up, and we had nearly set the bar on fire. People, heed my warning. That stuff is Special Olympics in a pint glass. You think they're harmless and not very strong, and next thing you know is about an hour later, you're in the bathroom of the bar with your pants off, surrounded by 5 girls, giving your boxers to a bachelorette party because one of the girls is cute and told you she had a nice butt. Be forewarned. After that little fiasco, we head across the street to a dueling piano bar. We discover that one of the 2 piano players is blind. My friends and I are basically jackals who walk on 2 legs, so true to our nature, we focus on the weak one. We must have given him about 20 of those notes with song titles on them. Finally, the blind piano player stopped his music and said, "Hey, idiots! Stop giving me written song suggestions! I'm blind! Blind! I can't read them!" One of the helpers came over and took the song suggestions over to the piano player who could see, and he broke out laughing so hard he couldn't even keep playing. He kind of stopped the music and said into his mic, "Well, I would love to play these songs, but unfortunately I don't know any of them. Let's see if you know them, Phil. They are Please Kill Yourself, Isn't Ray Charles Supposed to Be Black, I'm Gonna Steal Your Wallet Because You Can't See Who I Am, Have You Ever Fucked a Goat by Accident, You Are Blind Because You Masturbated Too Much as a Child, I'm Gonna Set Your Hair on Fire, Come to the Bathroom So I Can Fillet You, I Bet You Fuck Ugly Girls Because You Can't See Their Faces, I Pissed on Your Shoes When You Were at the Urinal," and so on and so on. Phil, you know any of these? I'm stumped. It was awesome. And the irony was that while most of the crowd was aghast, the blind guy was laughing his ass off right along with us. I guess crippled people can be useful sometimes. After a few more beers, we went on to another bar, and another bar, and another bar, ad infinitum. The night was very funny, for us, because we were not nice people. Here's some selections of our behavior at the various bars on 6th Street that night. At one point, I went up to some deaf people who were signing to each other and began signing with them. I actually know ASL because I took sign language for my foreign language requirement at the University of Chicago, and as I was asking them where the hot sluts are, in sign language, PWJ comes up to me and says, "Tucker, I didn't know you spoke deaf." While traveling from one bar to the next, PWJ saw a lowrider El Camino with hydraulics that was bouncing up and down on 6th Street. He ran next to the car and started jumping up and down with the car and yells at the driver, "Nice car, man!" To which the driver, a male of obvious Hispanic descent, gives him a look of disgust and yells back, "Get away from my car, SA, or I'll fucking bust a cap in you, man." Of course, there were women. Countless women. Thousands, it seemed like. And most of them were hot. And all of them drunk. Some of the interactions I caught on my voice recorder. "Hey, sweetie, what's your name?" "My name is Pocahontas." "Right, bitch, and my fucking name is John Smith." Slingblade Barr whispers to me, "Tucker, that's not good game." So I ask her, "Are you married?" "Yes." "How good is the marriage?" "Very good." "So there's no chance of us hooking up?" "No." "Well, do you have any hot friends who aren't fucking prudes?" "Hey, where are you going? I was only kidding. I respect the sanctity of the monogamous relationship. Whore!" PWJ made me his wingman at one point, but the friend was a hideously fat girl I was supposed to hit on. I tried to end it quickly with this. "You don't want to talk to me. I have festering sores on my scrotum." She thought I was hilarious, so I had to bring out the heavy artillery. "So that spare tire you're carrying, is it for a car or a truck?" I played ignorance when PWJ asked me what happened. "I don't know, man. I was trying to help you out. She just wasn't into me. What can I do? Not all girls like me." Dirty took a picture of me and some girl and then said to her, "You can see these pictures of yourself on poopsex.com. She quickly scurried away. Slingblade was his usual charming gin-drunk self. His lines that night ran the gamut from awful to patently offensive to nearly criminal. His standard pickup line that night was, "I swear to Christ, pursuant to Megan's Law, I'm obligated to tell you that I am a convicted sex offender. So what's your name?" After I made him stop talking about molesting children, he moved on to these gems. "Oh good, you smoke. When you're done sucking down the death stick, I want your advice on which brand of vodka to chase my Percocet with. Or this one. Hey baby, can we just skip the pleasantries and go straight to the part where you call me Captain Kirk and give me a handjob in the back seat of my car?" Quite the wingman he was. This is my personal favorite interaction of the night. I walk up to a girl and say, "Do you mind if I flirt with you for a while?" She stares at me and says, "Please zip up your pants first. Thank you." "Oh, sorry. So what's your name?" "I didn't pay attention. Blah, blah, blah." "You have an underbite. Wait, come back here. I think that's sexy." Somehow, Slingblade managed to get a hot girl that he didn't think was a whore interested in him. Fascinated by this rare turn of events, I talked to her and immediately discovered the reason. The girl was not a day over 16. Well, maybe 17. He whispered to me, "This is what lawyers in Texas call the age of consent." There was only one barrier to Slingblade sealing the deal. She didn't believe that he went to Austin High with her. She asked him what the mascot was. He accused her of not knowing herself and trying to steal that information from him.